You're listening to the micro version of the Savage Lovecast, www.savagelovecast.com.
If you're stuck in a relationship quandary, or if you're looking for sexual harmony, well, there's nothing you can't ask on the Savage Lovecast.
There's a column at The Guardian, one of many columns at The Guardian, actually, that I really enjoy. It's about people's sex lives, stories that people submit to The Guardian about sex they're having, with whom they're having it. Not just hookups, also a lot of stuff about relationships. A little like Modern Love in the New York Times, but with the focus primarily on the fucking and the impact of the fucking and the repercussions of the fucking. And there's one today that caught my eye, and I wanted to draw your attention to it and share it with you because, well, it illustrates and kind of confirms two points I frequently make here on the Lovecast. This one is called My Life in Sex. I have sensual encounters with my masseur. It's written by a married woman, I believe in the UK, who says that 13 years ago, we, my husband and I, became parents and it sucked the wind out of my husband's sails. He became depressed and lost all interest in sex. A decade went by in which she and her husband had no sex. And she heard through a friend of a friend of a friend about a masseur, about a massage therapist who practices sensual but non-sexual massage. And she went to see this therapist, this massage therapist. And during their sessions, she would have orgasms without any direct intimate contact. And then she writes, I felt I could trust him and asked whether we could have sex. I lost my virginity to my husband and had never been with anyone else. But the thought of going through life having only been with one man who now didn't want sex was infuriating. 4 years after making my first appointment, we meet once or twice a year and have sex in an hours-long, languid, sensual encounter. She goes on to say that her husband is no longer depressed, that they have a good and decent relationship, but still very little to absolutely no sex. I do love him, the anonymous author writes, and wouldn't break up our family for the world. And what makes it possible for her to stay married and stay sane, as I like to say, is this massage therapist. I've frequently said that there are relationships, there are marriages that are saved by cheating. Marriages that should continue. She loves her husband. He loves her. They have kids together. They're a good couple. She loves her husband. He loves her. They have a family. She doesn't want to break her family up, but she would have to if she didn't have this release. Not only is this an example of one of those cases where cheating saves a marriage, this is also a case where, although this person calls themselves a masseuse and practices sensual massage, this is a case, I think, where a sex worker has saved a marriage. If you're doing sensual massage, that is, of course, sex work. And if you're doing sex work, the legit masseuse community out there doesn't want you to identify yourself as a masseuse or me to refer to you as a masseuse. So I'm going to refer to this person now as a sex worker. But this is an example of a sex worker who stepped in and saved a marriage by facilitating what? Release, by facilitating someone staying married and staying sane, by providing them with what their spouse is not interested in providing them with. Sex, intimacy, meeting this particular kind of need. And it's made it possible for this woman to keep her family together. And yeah, it's not ideal. And some people out there will say that she should do the right thing if she wants to have sex at all or with other people and divorce her husband. But her husband doesn't want to be divorced. And she doesn't want to divorce him. That's also in the piece. She wants, again, to keep her family together. And what's keeping her family together? Cheating and a sex worker. Cheating, of course, isn't going to save every marriage. Sex workers, of course, aren't always angels of mercy. Cheating can explode a marriage. Seeing a sex worker can explode a marriage. Infidelity, one of the leading causes of divorce, doesn't save marriages in every case. It's not chemotherapy. It's not a cure. It's not a cancer cure. But the way we talk about cheating, the way we talk about sex workers, particularly sex workers who see people who are in committed relationships, always makes them sound like the problem and the threat. It's a little more nuanced than that. It's a little bit more ambiguous than that, a little more complicated than that. But we don't usually hear about these kinds of examples. We don't usually hear about the marriages, the relationships saved by cheating, saved by sex workers, because there's no public scandal, there's no divorce, there's no reason for the divorce, there's no gossip, there's no chatter. It happens below everyone's radar. Every once in a while, though, it surfaces. Every once in a while, you see an example like this. Again, the column at The Guardian is, I have sensual encounters with my masseur. It's their My Life in Sex column. And if you're not reading it, you should be. All right, coming up on today's show, we've got tons of your Q's, lots of my A's. And on the micro edition of the Savage Lovecast, we have a call from a listener who's being terrorized by one of her exes who's putting her private photographs online. And we've got Carrie Goldberg, victims' rights advocate, pioneering victims' rights advocate. She prosecutes online harassers and revenge pornographers, and she's here to help our listener on today's show. This episode is brought to you by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Check out this week's menu and get $30 off your first meal with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/savage. Me Undies makes feel-good underpants your butt will be proud to wear and you will be proud to be seen in. They will be the most comfortable pair of underwear you will ever own. And to check it out yourself, go to meundies.com/savage. This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by Everlane, luxury basic clothing and accessories made at ethical factories without those retail markups. For free shipping and to support the Lovecast, go to everlane.com/savage.
Hey, Dan, I'm calling because I am considering cutting a kind of chunk of people out of my life, and I just wanted to hear your thoughts on the situation. So I had a good friend for quite a few years, and for various reasons I won't get into, the friendship, you know, turned kind of toxic over a course of like the last 2 years, and so we took a break from seeing each other, like a 6-month break. We didn't really mutually agree to do it. It just happened, and I started to feel better, but then she started reaching out to me again, and I like to give people other chances. So I would say I've seen her like 3 times in the last 2 months. And it's been fun until this last time. She says to me that she's worried about me and my friends are really worried about me. And that, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10 of like people's lives being on the edge or something, that I'm at a 10. And so I said, okay, well, what is it? You know, tell me why you're worried about me and what friends are worried about me. And she wouldn't really elaborate, just said I seem really unhappy. And I think that's bullshit. I've had some tough times. I did have a really tough year. And I probably exhausted my friends' capacity to listen to me complain and bitch. But overall, my life is fine. I'm not that unhappy. I'm just kind of struggling a little bit with a few things. Like I don't like my job, and my husband and I have had some major disagreements, but overall we're happy together. The more I think about it, the more it pisses me off, because it just seems like it's more about controlling or being judgmental. So anyway, I've decided not to see this girl again because it's just like, it's not worth it. But then I'm thinking about the only friends we have in common. It's like 5 or 6 people. And even though she wouldn't specify, I'm thinking this means that when I'm not around, they like sit around and discuss me. So I'm thinking of not seeing any of those motherfuckers either. Oh, and also I kind of checked in with a couple of other friends that I have like from other parts of my life who I have been seeing a lot more of lately. And they're like, no, I'm not worried about you at all. Like sometimes you're a little, you know, neurotic, which I am, but you know, you're fine. I'm not worried about you. So I'm thinking of just cutting out this group of like 6 or 7. But do you think I'm being crazy? Like I want to be able to be introspective and see like when the choices I make maybe aren't good or healthy. But honestly, like who needs that shit, right?
It's possible that everyone in this sort of chunk of your social circle, these friends, these 6, are terribly, terribly shitty people. Like attracts like, birds of a feather flock together, all the cliches occasionally apply, and maybe they're just awful and they all need to go. And your other friends tell you that, yeah, you've been bitching a little bit about work and marriage issues and you seem not entirely happy all the time, but it's not as bad as all that. And maybe they're right. And maybe these shitty people are underminers and they just want to drag you down and pick you apart for God knows what reason. It's a good idea when you recognize that there's a clique of shitty people in your life to walk away from those shitty people and to withdraw from those shitty people and focus your time and your energies and the emotional investments you're able to make in your friendships on people who aren't so shitty, if indeed these are shitty people. I think, however, that a moment's introspection is called for. If you've been you say, in a bad place at work and marriage on the rocks a little bit, but you guys are coming through and pulling out of that. If every time you saw your friends, you just launched into your complaints and you weren't there for them, you didn't listen to them, and you had not a nice thing to say about anyone or anything, and you were just venting, then it might be you. You may have contributed to the souring of this group. And yeah, maybe they were all talking with each other about you. Maybe you came up and they were like, God, just every time we see her, it's just we have to sit in silence and listen to this torrent of complaints. And I'm not saying that's what you did. I'm not saying that that's what happened. But I think you need to ask yourself if that's what you did, if that is indeed what happened, if you played a part in souring this small group on you, or not even souring them. It sounds like your friend came to you to express concern. Maybe she was nominated by the group to go to you and check in and be like, come on, how are you doing? Like, what's up? I don't want to commodify friendships, but there is a give and take. There's a pay in and withdraw aspect to a friendship where people will be there for you in the tough times and listen to you vent and get it off your chest in exchange, not just for you doing the same for them when they're facing tough times and they need to vent, but in exchange also for pleasure and joy and companionship and good times. And if you were drawing on the friendship bank a lot over the last year or two, and it was all, I need your support, I need to vent, I need to support, I need to vent, and it was no, I'm here to give you support, I'm here for you to vent to too, and no, let's have fun, let's play a game, let's go to a movie, let's have dinner, let's talk about other shit and have a laugh. If there was none of those, really, not to commodify it, but compensatory sort of exchanges, then yeah, friends can sour on you. You can lose friends that way. You can overtax them. You can make too many withdrawals. You can deplete your account at the friendship bank. You need to be thoughtful about that. Not saying that these people aren't six deeply shitty people that you should cut out of your life and need to cut out of your life, and I support you in cutting them out of your life, but a moment's introspection before you cut six people out of your life is called for.
Hi, Dan. This is a bi mother of two, married for 8 years, living in the Pacific Northwest. And I just had a question. My husband has been exploring his genderqueerness, which is cool. Like, he just wants to wear women's clothing. It's sexy, it's comfortable. And in all honesty, if he, you know, with all this communication, if he decided that a penis wasn't in his idea of gender for himself, I would be totally cool with it. Now, the problem is that he keeps wearing my clothes. And most of the time, that's fine. But like I said, I'm a mother of two. They're both two and under. And I don't have new stuff for me hardly ever. I'm a bigger girl, size 40 in men. And he's a size 29, 30 waist in men. And so he can fit into my stuff. I can't fit into his. It takes me a long time to find clothes on clearance, on sale, so that we're saving money. And he's a size small in women, so he's just finding shit all of the time. And it's making me feel like crappy. I didn't grow up with siblings who took my stuff. And it's feeling more and more like my husband is a little sister trying to wear my dress to school or my brand new boots that I've looked for years, or I don't know. And it just sucks. I'm so happy he's exploring the side of himself. And I love seeing him in his yoga pants and his skirts, and wants to buy a new bra. But fuck, man, I'm nursing. And I haven't had a new bra in over 2 years. You don't get a new bra. Like, it doesn't. It just sucks. So, Dan, how do I not be jealous? How do I support him in finding his style and what makes him comfortable and wearing stuff out of the house that looks good on him and makes him feel sexy without it being my stuff that makes me comfortable and makes me feel sexy?
I think it's perfectly reasonable to say to your spouse, and it doesn't mean you aren't supportive of his gender journey, to tell him that you don't want him wearing your clothes. You're not comfortable with him wearing your clothes, that your clothes are about your own self-expression, and seeing him grab them and wear them is interfering with your own self-expression or your attachment, your emotional attachment to your own garments and the wardrobe that you have assembled with great difficulty because of your size and the inability of the fashion industry or the clothing industry to provide clothes for you that you're comfortable in, that you can afford. However, then he's going to have to purchase clothes. And it sounds like you also have a little bit of an issue with that, that you're scrimping and saving, money is tight, you find things on sale, and he's running out and buying a new bra. Well, if he didn't buy a new bra, then he might be wearing yours, and you don't want him wearing yours. Now, there are used bras out there in the world. There is goodwill out there in the world. And if he's comfortable wearing clothes that aren't brand new, which is what he does when he wears your clothes, theoretically, he would be comfortable wearing clothes that he bought in a used clothing store or a vintage clothing store at a hopefully steep discount, nowhere near new clothes retail. And you could encourage him to do that. But I think you're allowed to have boundaries. You can be supportive and have boundaries. You can be supportive of his journey. You can be supportive of his exploration of his gender queerness or whatever it is, and say to him, but my support ends where my dresser drawers begin. These are my clothes, and you need to get your own clothing, not just borrow mine. And if finances are tight, you have a right, your responsibility to say to him, and it's not supportive of his gender thing to say, and you got to get your ass to Goodwill, and we can't afford to be spending a lot of money right now on new clothes, new bras, new dresses, new skirts, new yoga pants. Let's go out there, and I'll go out there with you and help you shop. Let's go out there together and find stuff at the secondhand stores, at the flea markets, and the consignment shops that are yours and about you and about your expression and about your exploration and cheap. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone, even inept in the kitchen types like me. Blue Apron can help you improve your cooking skills because they give you step-by-step instructions and offer a huge selection of cuisines and cooking styles. If you are new to cooking, Blue Apron is a great way to start. Here are some menu items coming up next week. Fried chicken and kale slaw with roasted sweet potato and hot honey, and paneer and lentil masala with spinach and lime rice. Check out this week's menu and get $30 off your first meal with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/savage. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so do not wait. That's blueapron.com/savage. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Hi, Dan. I'm a 48-year-old cisgender straight married man about to celebrate his 20th wedding anniversary tomorrow. I do mean celebrate. My wife and I agree that we're happier together now than we've ever been, partly thanks to you, because 5 years ago this outcome didn't seem likely. We were both committed Christians when we married, and we followed the rules. We didn't sleep together until the wedding night. I actually lived at her parents' for 2 months when we bought a house before the wedding to avoid temptation. After we got married, surprise, we discovered we had mismatched libidos and no foundation for even talking about sex. We tried counseling to no avail. At a men's prayer group I attended, this seemed to be the norm. Most of the men watched porn, felt guilty about it, and prayed that God would help them to honor their wives and not want sex so much. 6 years ago, right after New York State legalized same-sex marriage, a pastor at our church delivered a vile sermon against homosexuality. My wife stood up in the middle, took our daughter by the hand, left the church, and hasn't been back since. It took me longer because I worked for the church, also because I wasn't ready yet. 3 years ago, we discovered your podcast and started talking about the calls and the issues they raised. This past summer, my wife surprised me by saying that she was ready to open up our marriage to ethical non-monogamy. She'd been thinking about it for a long time and realized that we each do other activities with members of the opposite sex. In her words, "You go to movies with other women, and I don't worry that I'll lose you. You travel to run out-of-town marathons with other women, and I don't worry I'll lose you. So why does it have to be any different if you sleep with another woman?" Because here's the thing. Except for sex, we line up. We check most of the boxes for each other. We're great roommates. We have a daughter together. We're politically compatible. We have financial interests in common. We really like each other. We're best friends. We don't want a divorce, but we do want each other to be happy and fulfilled, which is where this arrangement came from. Just talking about the elephant in the room finally lifted a huge weight from both of us. Years of frustration and resentment faded away just by talking about the possibility of opening the marriage. I didn't even know if anything would come of it, but then I attended my 30-year class reunion, had a spark with an old friend who was in the final stages of divorce. I asked my wife for her okay, which is part of our ground rules, and she said yes. She even connected with my friend on Facebook. This has been life-changing in so many ways I don't need to get into. Long story short, Dan, your program opened our eyes and planted seeds that have come to fruition, helped make this anniversary a real celebration. Because we're completely open about this, we've told friends. The main concern seems to be, what if someone catches feelings and wants to leave? My wife replies, that could happen whether or not we have an open marriage. As we told our daughter when we explained our decision to her, we're doing this because we don't want to divorce. So thank you, Dan, Nancy, and the Tech Savvy At-Risk Youth. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much for your call, and thanks also to your wife for walking out when the pastor delivered the anti-gay sermon. We need more people to take those kinds of stands in their houses of worship. And congratulations, and keep communicating, keep talking to each other. But I wanted to play the call. We usually don't play a lot of complimentary calls. I wanted to play the call because it's a good example of something I've talked about before, which is when non-monogamy saves a relationship, when it saves a marriage, we rarely hear about it because most people who open their marriages, who open their relationships in order to save them, because everything is working except the sex. And there's a lot of contentiousness about trying to make that sex work. And it generates a lot of conflict in the relationship. And some people open the relationship, and then that conflict over sex and fulfillment and the resentments evaporate because they're no longer looking to each other to meet that need. And they're getting that need met elsewhere. And they've eliminated the central conflict in the relationship. And suddenly the relationship, the marriage, is much better, much more stable. And like you said to your daughter, you're doing this because you don't want to get divorced. And when openness saves a marriage, saves a relationship, particularly a straight one, we almost never hear about it because most people in open relationships who are straight are not out. We hear about it if it comes to shit. We hear about it if openness or somebody meeting somebody else results in the divorce that you two have opened your marriage to avoid. Then we all hear about it. And then everybody goes, ah, see, anytime anybody opens marriage, anytime anybody opens a relationship, that's the death knell. That's the beginning of the end. And people say that in a room sometimes with people who have been in successful, long-term, open relationships for decades who have their mouths sewn shut, who don't speak up at that moment because they don't want to be out, because they aren't ready to bear up under the stigma or the judgment or the shame that so many people who are honest about being in open relationships, myself included, are often subjected to. But you don't want it to come to shit. You don't want to be that story in 2 years or 5 years. So my advice to you and your wife, continue to prioritize each other's emotional security. Continue to be intimate with one another. Continue to invest in your marriage, in your relationship, in your friendship, in your partnership, including the intimacy. And I'm not saying sex. I'm not using intimacy and sex interchangeably here. But physical contact, physical affection, expressions of love are really important. Even if you are seeking sexual fulfillment elsewhere, and so is she, turning to each other, looking at each other and saying, I love you, and you are the reason I can have it all, that I have sexual fulfillment, but not with you necessarily. We tried, that didn't work. But I have sexual fulfillment with others, as do you, and I have everything else that we do for each other, everything else our relationship is about. I get to have that too. Because of you, because of who you are, because of who I am, because of who we are together. And that is wonderful and valuable. So continue to honor and respect and love each other and prioritize each other. And you won't become the cautionary tale in 2 years or 5 years or 10 years that everybody points to say, ah, see, always the death knell, always the beginning and the end. Thanks so much for your call. With tons of styles and patterns to choose from for both men and women, MeUndies has underpants you are going to love for sure. And you can and you should give them as gifts. The MeUndie feeling is unmatched because they use a naturally soft fabric that is 3 times softer than cotton. And for a limited time only, check out MeUndies' first ever glow-in-the-dark print, Lights Out. Why not update your underwear drawer and glow in the dark at the same time? Make your ass easier to find in the dark. And if underwear isn't your thing, MeUndies also makes the softest socks in the world. Nancy loves her MeUndies. She's especially fond of the G.I. Joe pattern, and her eyes went wide when she heard about the glow-in-the-dark print. To get 20% off the best and softest underwear and socks you will ever own, free shipping and 100% satisfaction guarantee, and to support the Lovecast, go to MeUndies.com/savage. That's MeUndies.com/savage.
Hey, Dan. It's a 53-year-old gay guy down in Houston. And I saw a headline recently, undetectable equals untransmissible. Evidently, the CDC, based on three long-term studies, have determined that an undetectable viral load equals untransmissible virus via sex. I've been waiting for you to comment. I've heard no one comment on this. I'd love to get your opinion. And is it time to go bareback?
A lot of people wear bareback all along. Bareback, of course, is slang for anal intercourse, usually between two men, where no condom is used. Barebacking. The CDC recently announced what others have announced, what other organizations, AIDS organizations, medical organizations, particularly European health agencies, that if someone has an undetectable viral load, that they are uninfectious, that undetectable equals uninfectious. Does that mean everybody should go bareback now? Well, there's still an element of trust here. You meet someone, you don't meet their doctor at the same time. You're not getting their lab results in real time. They tell you that they're undetectable. Are they? Have they been taking their drugs? Are they undetectable? You're taking a leap of faith there. I think in the context of a committed long-term relationship where, you know, you're up on each other's health and you know whether they're taking their meds, that, yeah, I think barebacking is appropriate. I also think the other partner, if it's a serodiscordant relationship where one is positive and one is negative, the other partner should be on PrEP. And then it's no problem. Go bareback. However, some people are taking undetectable equals uninfectious and PrEP to mean that we can all just throw our condoms away and nobody needs to worry anymore. Well, there are other sexually transmitted infections out there. Syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia. There's a drug-resistant strain of gonorrhea that health experts are very, very concerned about. There's the skin-to-skin contact one, herpes, HPV, that condoms don't provide as good or as effective protection from as they do for syphilis and gonorrhea, chlamydia and HIV, but they provide some degree of protection. So we should be concerned about those other sexually transmitted infections too. It's a raging syphilis epidemic in the gay community. We should be concerned about that. We should also be concerned about the possibility of an unknown sexually transmitted infection popping up. This happened already once, a hitherto unknown fatal sexually transmitted infection appeared on the scene and killed all my friends. This is a thing that happened, and this is a thing that could happen again. So I don't think we should throw the condoms away. I don't think we should all go bareback. I think there are more complicated and nuanced discussions. There are more complicated and nuanced trade-offs people are making, rationalization sometimes people are making, but also people are weighing the risks and the rewards and making a new calculation about the degree of risk they're willing to tolerate for the reward of not having to worry about condoms or going bareback. But I don't think PrEP and I don't think undetectable equals uninfectious means that we should close down the condom factories and that nobody needs to ever use a condom again. There are people out there who aren't in treatment who are infectious. There are people out there who believe themselves to have a zero viral load because they did last time they got checked and perhaps haven't been drug compliant since. And there are, and crucially, there are other sexually transmitted infections out there in the world that we should be concerned about and using condoms to protect ourselves from. Would you buy a t-shirt for $50 if you knew it only cost $7 to make? If you're my husband, I know the answer to that question, but I wouldn't, and you probably wouldn't either. With Everlane, you will never have to overpay again for quality clothes. Everlane only makes premium essentials using the finest materials without traditional markups, and they tell you their real costs, so you know you're never overpaying. Everlane wants you to know what you're paying for and why. They are radically transparent about every step in their process, from the materials they use to the ethical factories they work with. Because Everlane sells directly to you, their prices are 30 to 50% lower than traditional retailers. Everlane's clothes look better, cost less, and last longer. Essentials like their Cotton Crew t-shirt are exactly what they should be. Simple, stylish, and made from quality materials. I love the Cotton Crew and also the men's Japanese Oxford. Nancy loves the Boss boot because, well, of course she does. Nancy is the boss. Everlane's timeless essentials are just what you're looking for. No frills, just quality. And right now you'll get free shipping on your first order when you go to everlane.com/savage. That's everlane.com/savage. Everlane.com/savage.
Hey, Dan, 27-year-old living in a liberal bubble in the South, and I need some advice on something. Last week, I got a message that there were naked pictures of me on Craigslist saying, guess where I work or my name, and I'll show you my open cut. I emailed Craigslist, and they got down pretty quickly. But I had another friend message me and say that my ex had sent him pictures, quote unquote, accidentally of me. I, you know, reported the messages, but I don't know if I should take further action. My ex-boyfriend, we just dated for like 6 or 7 months, and we've been broken up for about the same amount of time. It's only been recently where I blocked him on social media and everything because I just can't talk to him. I hyperperspirate. He just acts like a fucking chode, and I just don't know if I should take other actions or if I should pretend like it's not happening. Let me know.
Joining me by phone to help tackle this question, Carrie Goldberg. She's a victims' rights lawyer. Her firm is based in Brooklyn. It's C.A. Goldberg Law. They're at cagoldberglaw.com, and they are a pioneering, crusading firm in the field of revenge porn, domestic violence, sexual assault, and public figure crisis. Hey, Carrie, thank you for jumping on the phone.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So before we get to the specifics of this caller's question, you were inspired to get into this field, the sort of emerging field of revenge porn, some years ago because you were a victim or you were threatened by someone in a similar way as to the caller. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. And basically, after my whole crisis was resolved, I decided that I was going to become the lawyer that I'd needed when I'd been unable to find one myself. And I have. We've helped hundreds of people who've been the victims of stalking, sexual assault, blackmail, on and off. What I always like to say is that we stalk trolls, assholes, pervs, and psychos, but I think I might add total chodes to that list.
Yeah, and the total chodes out there, they need stopping. And just a decade ago, there were no laws against this kind of harassment. You know, you share pictures with someone while you're intimate, while you like them, and then they weaponize them after if the relationship goes south. They send them to your mom, they send them to your colleagues, some of your coworkers, they post them on, you know, social media sites or Craigslist. And tell us about the emerging sort of jurisprudence of, pardon me, I mispronounced that word, the emerging jurisprudence of revenge porn. And the criminalization of these assaults.
Right. Well, so as you said, like there were no laws 10 years ago. And now we have 37 states that have criminal laws outlawing and sometimes sending to jail anybody who posts non-consensual sexually graphic images or videos. So that's a huge change. And also over the last couple years, we've gotten tech companies to be on board. So Twitter, Facebook, even Google now have policies within their platforms that ban revenge porn as well.
So you can lose all your social media sites. You can get shut down by these companies. They're not just going to pull down the posts that you may put up. They're also going to block you and delete your accounts. Is that right?
Right, right. A lot of times the offender will create impersonating accounts as if they were our victim, and then friend everybody in his or her life and then post the revenge porn just to kind of do the ultimate harm. And now we can easily get those profiles taken down.
So when you drag one of these assholes into court, do they crumble? Are they as vicious in person? I mean, I'm sure you've gone face to face and toe to toe with some of these revenge pornographers, which I think is too glamorous a term for them. But with some of these assholes, some of these chodes, what are they like when they're called to account?
Oh, they're total chodes in real life. They always, you know, are very regretful. But of course, we all know that they regret being caught more than they regret the actual actions. And they sometimes, you know, sometimes the offender gets named in the media for having been arrested for revenge porn. And they always like to say that their privacy was violated for being outed as a revenge pornographer.
Oh my God. The arson was bad, but that I got outed as the arsonist, that's the real crime.
Exactly. Exactly.
So what would your advice be for this particular caller? First thing, probably to look up the statutes in her state, to Google revenge porn in the name of her state and see if it's she lives in one of the 37 states where it's a criminal offense would be the first move, would it not?
That's exactly what she should do. And even if she's in one of those states that doesn't have a specific revenge porn law, it sounds like this guy may have broken other laws as well. I mean, he impersonated her on Craigslist and held her out as a hooker. You know, that could violate other crimes. You know, if the pictures were taken without her consent or knowledge, that could trigger video voyeurism laws if they're underage. If he threatened to release them before he actually released them, then that could trigger coercion laws. So even for people who don't have the luxury of living in one of those 37 states plus Washington, D.C., they may still have law enforcement options. So after she finds out if her state is one, we'd also want her to, I mean, I think she should hire a lawyer. This guy is escalating. This isn't just revenge porn, but this is also an escalation that's quite serious. Him impersonating her and holding her out as a hooker. A lot of revenge porn victims are desperately fearful that the kind of downstream harassers, the people who view the revenge porn, are going to show up at their homes mm-hmm. or their workplace. Because in the majority of cases, personal identifying information is posted alongside the revenge porn. And in this case, she said that he basically made a challenge for people to out where she works and what her name is. And so that's an invitation for other, you know, unsavory people to contact her, which is quite dangerous.
One of the things that's most galling about revenge porn is often the victim is further victimized. People who have been victimized by assholes, by chodes, sharing their photos without their consent will lose their jobs, will get in trouble with their families, have lost friends, because they're treated like the ones who did something wrong and taking the pictures in the first place. How do we combat that? I mean, that just seems crazy to me because almost everybody is flirting online, sharing pictures online, initiating relationships online through dating sites where you may swap pics. We have kind of fully incorporated this technology into not just our dating and romantic lives, but also into our sex lives and our erotic imaginations. And it's rare to find someone who hasn't shared these pictures. And yet it seems so often that when someone is victimized like this, the judgment and the shaming is not directed at the victimizer, but the victim.
That's absolutely true. And what I like to tell those people is that every single one of us is a moment away from meeting somebody who becomes hellbent on our destruction. And revenge porn often is not usually is happens within the context of other stalker type behavior. And, you know, we have a client who was the victim of revenge porn and also impersonation that resulted in several people coming to her home thinking that she was a hooker, similar to this case. And the offender was arrested last Thursday and is being charged federally. And so
awesome.
It's a big, exciting thing, but she'd never shared a picture. She had hacked into her computer and was blackmailing her with her entries from her diary about her abortion and about sex that she'd had, and was sending that to hundreds of people in her life. And you know, you don't have to send naked pictures, although I totally see nothing wrong with it. You know, it is part of dating and mating behavior nowadays. But anybody can be the victim of a privacy violation. We have clients whose bikinis were photoshopped off of a picture that was found on Facebook, or whose head was photoshopped onto a porn star's body. So you don't actually have to have even taken the picture. And one of I don't want to give the offenders ideas. So if you're listening, offenders, to this podcast,
fuck off.
Please know we will find you. So don't take any of the ideas. But one of the other things that I've been seeing a lot lately are like collages. So an offender will create a collage of the victim's face and body and just regular clothes pictures, and then also include vagina shots or penis shots if the victim's a male.
To suggest that these are pictures of their penis or their vagina by sort of association or proximity, when in actual fact, that's not mm-hmm. that person's genitalia.
Exactly.
It's so upsetting. And, you know, I'm upset most at the chodes. Of course I'm upset at the chodes. But I'm always flabbergasted at the shamers and the judgers and the firers when it comes to people who've lost their jobs as a result of this sort of thing. And people who work with kids are, you know, teachers, I think, are particularly vulnerable to this kind of bullshit. And sometimes what's said, and I'm curious what you would say, sometimes what's said by the shamers who are putting the blame in the wrong place is, well, you shouldn't take pictures like this. You shouldn't have shared pictures like this. No one should take or share pictures like this. Is that your advice to? Because you never know that someone's an asshole or a chode until after you've dated them for a while. That's something you discover and you stop dating them because they reveal themselves to be a fucking asshole. And you dump them. And then if early in the relationship or when you were still besotted or before they had dropped the mask and showed you who they really are, you shared stuff with them that everybody might be sharing with people that they loved and trust and were investing in emotionally. So is your advice, don't share those pictures until after your 15th wedding anniversary? What's your advice for people who are thinking about taking a picture of their genitals?
My advice is basically consenting to share an image with one person is not consenting for that person to then share it with the entire internet and put your genitals on a platter for people to consume. But, you know, it's like we don't judge people whose home has been burglarized. We don't tell them, well, that's what you get for having a house
and owning a TV that could be seen through the window.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, if I give somebody my credit card, you know, when I'm buying a pair of shoes, I'm not consenting for them to go out and buy a Ferrari. So, you know, it's consent is context specific. But the other thing is that, you know, not every case is that of the jilted ex who's trying to avenge himself after a breakup. Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes the nude pictures are obtained other ways, through hacking. Sometimes victims are passed out. And there was a big case at Penn State where there was a private Facebook page where some fraternity brothers were just posting pictures of girls, naked girls who'd passed out at their parties.
It's so rare to hear the phrase, some fraternity brothers were, and then have a good thing come after that. Some fraternity brothers were raising money for Puerto Rico relief. I'm sure there are probably some fraternity brothers out there right now raising money for Puerto Rico relief, and we'll hear from them, but it's just so rare. It's like the Texas State Legislature today is what comes next is never good, or rarely good, if ever good. One last question, and I'm just curious what you might think about this. I think there should be a national holiday where everybody releases their dirty pictures online, because once everybody has their dirty pictures out there, one person's dirty pictures can't be leveraged against them, can't be weaponized. And I just feel like, looking around, everybody's taking these pictures, particularly everybody under 50 is taking these pictures. And yet everybody acts with shock and horror when someone else's picture's out there. And you just look at people and say, well, what about your pictures? And I worry about our kids who are, you know, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19 years old, sometimes getting tripped up with the, you know, sexting laws and child porn laws being used against children, which is ridiculous, and who are so vulnerable because everybody's pictures aren't out. But if we live in a world one day where everybody's pictures are out, then nobody can be dinged for it. Am I just being utopian and irrational and unrealistic?
Maybe. I think everyone should have the right to their sexual privacy. But I
agree
what you're saying. You know, I think people should maybe have the option to release their own. And certainly that does exist. There's plenty of pornography out there, which makes it even more shocking that there is such a market for non-consensual pornography. But, you know, I agree that there's just nothing pervy about taking the pictures.
Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't tell someone not to take a picture if they felt so motivated to take a picture and share?
No. I mean, I would have a different conversation with an underage person
as I have on this
story.
Show plenty of times. But like someone who's 22 years old, who's dating somebody, maybe it's a long distance right now, and they're jumping on Skype or swapping some dirty pictures to keep that spark glowing. You wouldn't advise that person, based on, you know, the horror stories that you've heard, never to do that. Would you?
No. It's age-old tradition. Our soldiers used to go off to war with hot pictures of their girls in their pockets. There's mm-hmm. there's nothing exceptional about sharing intimate images. What's exceptional is you know, furthering the distribution without consent.
Before we let you go, circling back to the caller, your advice, go get a lawyer.
Well, okay. But first of all, I want to just say one more thing to the caller. It's that, you know, she's like, should I just ignore this? You know, I think she did take some great action. She got the ad removed from Craigslist. Other things that she can do without having to get a lawyer include reporting it to law enforcement if her state is one of those things. But the other thing that she did that was quite active is that she called one of the leading podcasts in the country to talk about this. So that's some pretty creative self-advocacy, if you ask me.
And we got her actually some legal advice from the best lawyer out there addressing these issues right now, which is you, Carrie.
Thank you. Oh, but I should asterisk that this was not legal advice.
That's right. This is just
this was all
you
hypothetical.
And I shooting the shit. Before we look at one last question about the Chodes. Is it enough sometimes for someone just to get a letter, a kind of a cease and desist letter from a lawyer saying, are you aware of these statutes, and the possible criminal charges that may be brought against you and the liability that you may incur, loss of freedom, fines? Have you found in your practice that sometimes it's enough for the asshole to get that letter, to stop it, to shut them down?
Sometimes a cease and desist is enough. It kind of depends where on the scale between or the spectrum between asshole and psycho the person is. Usually it takes a handcuff to stop a psycho. If somebody is on a war path or, you know, just kind of tornadoing around, destroying a person's life as their full-time occupation, then you got to get law enforcement involved.
Good advice. Carrie Goldberg of the C.A. Goldberg Law Firm, cagoldberglaw.com is where you can find them online. You can also jump on The New Yorker and read Margaret Talbot's excellent profile of Carrie Goldberg. Thank you, Carrie, for jumping on the phone today. I really appreciate it. It was great chatting with you.
Thank you, Dan.
Yeah, hi. I have a question about my child's Halloween costume. My wife and I are very progressive people. We've always supported gay rights and all of that, and taught our children that as well. And apparently, my children, who are 10 and 12 in 5th and 7th grade, have talked to my wife and decided that they want to go as gay rights, which I'm totally fine with, but it appears that it involves a fair amount of flamboyance. And my wife doesn't have an issue with this. And personally, my concern is that this might be some type of gay blackface, for lack of a better term. I don't know how to put it. I don't care what other people think in terms of them supporting gay rights, any of that stuff. I'm all for it. I just don't want it to come off looking like they're might be sort of making fun of gay people. So what would your guidelines be for kids who want to do gay pride Halloween costumes?
Not all gay people are flamboyant. Of course, there's always been a streak of flamboyance and showmanship and flash in gay rights demonstrations, and a lot of queer rights activists brought their sort of queer sensibilities and artistic flair and style to gay rights demonstrations. But not all people who participated in gay rights demonstrations, and not all people who advocated for gay rights, not all gay people are flamboyant. And it is a little kind of cluelessly reductive to boil the whole LGBT civil rights struggle down to flashy. If your kids want to dress up as fabulous queers on Halloween, I totally support that. But push them in the direction of a fabulous queer. Encourage them to be Hedwig for Halloween. Or if they really want to reach back in time for a pop culture reference that most of their contemporaries will not be familiar with, expose them on YouTube to a little bit of Liberace and bring Liberace back for Halloween. Or if your kids want to be something scary and make a pro-gay rights statement in a kind of Halloween scary way, have them dress up as any one of Trump's judicial nominees at any level of the federal judiciary. That's some terrifying shit right there. But I think you do need to have a conversation with your kids about not tokenizing gay people, not boiling all gay people down to a sequin shirt and a feather boa and then calling that gay rights, because that ain't gay rights. It's a certain kind of gay flash, panache. Those very important people in the struggle for LGBT liberation, queer people who can't hide, don't hide, refuse to hide, queer people who got out there and were as fabulous and as fabulously queer as they could possibly be, who turned it up to 11. I don't think we would have made the progress we've made over the last 50 years without that kind of gay activism, those kinds of gay activists. But that ain't gay rights. Those are particular kinds of gay rights activists. And they're humans. They're not t-shirts. So have a combo with your kids. It's not akin, I think, to dressing up in blackface, nowhere near as offensive as that kind of minstrel show shit, blackface. No, not as offensive. But a little off the mark, a little clueless about what gay people are and what the whole LGBT civil rights struggle was about, and a great opening for you to have a conversation with your kids about all of that.
Hi, this is in reference to episode 573, where a couple of women complained that men had ghosted them after having sex. I have found that if I go on a date with somebody and then I'm thinking about having sex with them, but I'm really into them, and I would be upset if they somehow slut-shamed me and didn't want to hang out with me after we had quick sex, I can just ask, are you the kind of guy who doesn't really think about somebody seriously if you have sex with them quickly? And guys who lie about this tend to be pretty obvious, and guys who don't also tend to be pretty obvious. So that's something I found really useful. I don't tend to have sex with somebody who seems like they're the kind of person who couldn't take someone seriously after having sex with them really quickly.
This is in response to the guy whose Grindr date wants to do when he comes in for his drug test. I've been a secretary most of my career, and lots of my boyfriends have wanted to do me on my desk in my pencil skirt, but I don't want to get fired, so I've come up with a plan, and here's what you can do too. So you bring your scrubs and a sterile cup and whatever else you need to his hotel room, and you do a mock exam followed by crazy hot sex there in his hotel bathroom. That way you can both experience a fantasy without losing your job or your medical license, which is also a real possibility. Good luck and have fun.
Hey, Dan and the Tech Savvy at Risk Youth. I'm calling with a comment for the gal at the end of episode 573 who was not able to make out with her boyfriend because of his beard. I wanted to bring up laser hair removal for the guy. It's a drastic solution. It's a permanent solution to just not have hair grow on his face anymore. But I had it done on my neck. I used to get really bad ingrown hairs, and it was amazing. It takes a few sessions, and it hurts a little bit. But once it's done, the hair is just gone, and it never, ever comes back. So if he doesn't want to have a beard, maybe his beard's kind of a pain in the ass anyway, he could just get it removed, and it would never grow back.
And we're going to leave it there. 206-302-2064 is the number here at the Savage Lovecast. If you'd like to record a question or a comment for a future show, give us a buzz. 206-302-2064. Tickets are on sale now for the premiere of the 13th annual Hump Film Festival, premiering in Seattle and Portland and Olympia later this month. Go to humpfilmfest.com to order tickets. Shows are selling out fast. So, humpfilmfest.com, get your tickets now. Follow me on Twitter at FakeDanSavage. Follow Kerry Goldberg on Twitter at CA Goldberg Law. Savage Lovecast is produced every week by Nancy Hartunian and me and the Tech Savvy at Risk Youth and Nancy. We'll all be back at you next week with another installment of Savage Lovecast. Thanks for downloading.